Frank was a strange man, but he must have been. He wrote to you, didn't he? I said to him once or twice, explain something or other to me. And he'd say, oh, look at the index. You'll find it all in there. So I said, no, but tell me what you think about it. And I don't think he could.
History happened everywhere.
Hello, my name is Brian Weir, and I am here in the HHE studio with the Villeneuve to my Lynch. It's Mr. Peter Goddard.
I'm the Villeneuve?
Yeah, you are.
That's good. That means I'm the better one.
I'm the classic. Slightly erratic madman.
Bullshit.
You remind me today of a small Mexican chihuahua.
Now, Peter, with the whole world buzzing about the release of the movie Dune Part 2, I'm reminded that last episode we benched the Dursalator in favour of the Dunalator, which tasked you with looking for mindfulness in Frank Herbert's iconic sci-fi universe Dune, during the prequel years, no less, of 200 BG to 10,191 AG. Whatever that means. So, with that challenge set, why don't you give the listeners a pinch of spice and reveal what's to come on today's episode?
Well, yes, Ryan, it is a bit of a different one this week. We're going to travel through space and time to the universe of Dune, one of the most popular science fiction books ever written. And now, a major motion picture, not featuring Sting in his pants.
Hooray!
We're going to spice up your life with giant toothy worms. We're going to meet people who are like computers and computers who are like people. We're going to meet space nuns and fish people space truckers. We're going to find out what it means to be human, and throughout it all, we're going to be mindful of our chosen topic. It's mindfulness in the Duneverse during 200 BG to 10191 AG. Welcome to Dune.
Well, Peter, that all sounds enticing, and I cannot wait to hear more. Space nuns! But before we meditate any further, why don't you orient us on what and where the Duneverse is?
Well, Ryan, this episode has given me something of a dilemma, because previously we've done Lord of the Rings and Star Wars as our fictional versions of History Happened Everywhere. Both of those are pretty well-known cultural touchstones. But the problem is, I don't think a lot of people are nearly as familiar with Dune as they are with Star Wars and Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think it sits up there, but it's not quite as well known globally.
Exactly. So this gives me two problems. First of all, I think I need to introduce the background of the world a little bit more than we would normally. And secondly, I am going to try and avoid talking about the events after the start of the movie Dune, so that if you haven't seen the films yet, you won't be spoiled.
Nice, because I haven't seen the film yet.
Good. Neither have I, actually, so I'm not spoiling myself. Now, I'm going to start by going a little bit meta, and we're going to learn a little bit about Dune as an artwork.
Wow.
So the start and the heart of the story of the Duneverse is the book Dune. This was written by Frank Herbert over several years whilst his wife brought home the bacon, so I think she should get a bit of credit for the authorship there. It started life as a serialised story in a magazine called Analog, but then Herbert reworked it and sought to publish it as a book.
Okay.
This was rejected by nearly 20 book publishers.
Oh, wow. So not a good book.
Well, one editor apparently replied, "I might be making the mistake of the decade, but... dot, dot, dot." And indeed, in 1965, he found a publisher which was apparently mainly known for car repair manuals.
Right. Okay.
So these guys published it, and it went on to sell an estimated 20 million copies.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? It just goes to show, you just never can tell. It's really hard, I guess, publishing books and making films, and you just never know what's going
to
hit.
Exactly, and there are a good number of people who said no to this world-beating science fiction. And in fact, it's known as the best-selling science fiction book in history.
For real, really? More than 2001 or...
what'd they say?
Any of the Isaac Asimov? Oh, wow, there you go.
So anyway, from there, relatively successful, Herbert went on to expand the universe. He wrote 5 more books following the epic story of Dune. That's Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, God Emperor of Dune, Heretics of Dune, and Chapter House...
of Dune?
Correct. Chapter House Dune.
Oh, okay.
You know where you are. This guy knew branding, at least.
Yeah.
So that's so far so simple. One raw author, bunch of books, that's the world.
Okay.
Now, in 1984, there's a new entry into the Duneverse. There was a publication of a thing called the Dune Encyclopedia.
Okay.
Now, this was the first work that wasn't written by Frank Herbert at all. It was edited by a guy called Willis E. McNelly, and he was a close friend of Frank Herbert.
So this isn't like fan-written?
It sort of isn't. I mean, it's professional. So he gathered 42 writers, and they all wrote entries that in this encyclopedia contributing to the history and the personalities and the culture of the Duneverse.
Wow, this really does create an actual universe at this point, doesn't it?
It really does, and it's even better than that. So the effort that these guys produced was actually approved by Frank Herbert himself. He wrote the foreword to the book, and he wrote, "As the first Dune fan, I give this encyclopedia my delighted approval, although I hold my own counsel on some of the issues still to be explored as the chronicles unfold." Because he said that, because he was still writing the sequels at that time. So he's like, well, you know, something else happened.
Yeah.
It was because
you want some leeway, don't you? You don't want to be completely cornered in.
Exactly. He's got a little bit of a wriggle room. And he actually says, some of the contributions are sure to arouse controversy, based as they are on questionable sources.
Yeah. I mean, avid fans are well known for their inflexibility, aren't they, when it comes to this sort of stuff?
A little bit. But this is quite interesting, because the brilliant thing about the Dune Encyclopedia is it's written as an in-universe encyclopedia. So the Dune Encyclopedia is a book in the Dune universe.
Wait. What? Really? So if I lived in the Duneverse, I could go and buy this encyclopedia?
Exactly correct.
So with Frank Herbert's foreword?
Yeah, oh, God, that's blown my mind. I hadn't thought of that. Who is God has written this first foreword? But no, so the editor of the book is presented as this character, Hadi Bonotto, who's an archaeologist in the Frank Herbert novels.
I love this. This is cool.
Yeah, so it's basically, it acknowledges its own fallibility. It says, well, you know, there are powerful factions who won't have an interest in displaying one view of history. And so it kind of presents its own unreliableness as part of its whole setup.
Which is very good for Frank Herbert, because it gives him a lot of flexibility in the future if he needs to change something.
Of course, the encyclopedia, it was a bit wrong, but, you know, that's the nature of the book, right? So Frank Herbert died in 1986. He was going to write a 7th novel that he had apparently planned, but he didn't get there. But this still is not the end, Ryan.
Okay.
Unsurprisingly, a multi-million dollar enterprise continues. Frank's son, Brian Herbert, teams up with a guy named Kevin J. Anderson, and they pick up the reins of the Dune universe, supposedly using notes that were left behind by Frank after he died.
Okay, like Brian Henson picked up the reins of the Muppets.
Exactly, but there is some controversy. Some people would cast doubt onto whether these notes really exist. Apparently, the pair published a picture of the notes, but bear in mind this was, what, 1986 or thereabouts. The picture is just a floppy disk with a label that's just got handwritten June 7 notes.
Honestly.
It might as well have had honestly in brackets afterwards. But, you know, we've got no reason to believe they aren't the notes, but it's not exactly a load of handwritten notebooks we can refer to. But in any event, the pair go on to write another 15 books in the Dune series.
15? So how many in total now?
So it's 15 plus 6 from Frank and the encyclopedia.
22. Wow. Okay. Incredible. But then, what a universe it's creating.
It's a heck of a universe, but it's slightly unfortunate that the creation of these additional books also resulted in the children of Frank Herbert disavowing the Dune Encyclopedia. They published a comment saying, this isn't part of official Dune. They refused to let it be reprinted. And today you cannot buy a new copy. You have to buy a used copy or find a dodgy PDF online. Definitely don't do that. I didn't do it for a lot of this research. I can tell you that much. So yeah, they actually declared it no longer canon, the encyclopedia, in the official Herbert Limited Partnership, who owned the copyright for Dune. And that must have been heartbreaking for McNelly, because he wasn't just a fan fiction guy, he was a good friend of Frank Herbert's. He even wrote the eulogy for Herbert when he died.
Oh, wow. Was that in canon as well?
No, I think that was... it's such a sad story that, and to this day, you can't get it. You can buy a used copy, and it is very expensive, it turns out, unsurprisingly. So I've followed the lead of a podcast. There's a really big Dune podcast called Gom Jabbar. The way they operate canon is they say, first and foremost, Frank Herbert's novels are legit. Their second tier of legitimacy is actually the encyclopedia, because Frank Herbert had signed off on it effectively. And then only third do they bring in these new novels by the son of Frank Herbert.
Okay, so that at least that has some clarity to it then.
It does. And actually, whatever is canon, the Dune franchise keeps on rolling now in various media. There's been video games, there's role-playing games, there's a card game. And on screen, we have Dune from 1984.
It was a slow, dying death and a terrible
incredible experience.
There was a TV miniseries in the year 2000 called Frank Herbert's June.
Such a beautiful boy.
In 2003, there was another TV miniseries called Frank Herbert's Children of June.
It is my right to bear the royal heir.
And of course, in 2021, a movie called June, possibly the most successful installment of all of these other media, directed by Denis Villeneuve and starring Timothée Chalamet and winning 6 Oscars.
Just to correct you, it's actually Timothée Chalamet.
What?
That's his real name. His actual name, his birth name is Timothée Chalamet, but he refuses to use it because he says it sounds pretentious. So he just calls himself Timothy.
It's funny because my name is actually Head and Shoulders Goddard.
Oh, I see. Timothée.
Timothée shampoo is so mild, you can wash your hair as often as you wish.
And of course, Ryan, now we have the sequel to the blockbuster, June Part 2, in cinemas now, which is why we're doing this podcast.
And I did see in a recent interview for June Part 2, the director, Denis Villeneuve, he was saying that there are going to be a whole raft of spin-off movies and TV series that are going to follow on from the success of the major movies.
Oh, right. Well, I look forward to seeing those because there's a lot of material to get through.
There is. I don't think you're going to be able to avoid it, Pete. It's going to be everywhere.
Well, Denis, come and get in touch and we'll have you on the podcast next time there's a TV show to promote.
That's right. Or you, Timothée.
Timothée, so mild, you can wash your hair as often as you wish. Timothée.
Hey, Pete.
Hey, Ryan.
So I just finished reading June, right? And I gotta say, it was a little underwhelming.
Underwhelming, Ryan? June is a masterpiece. It's full of action and adventure. What didn't you like about it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, just not much happened, really. It was just a bunch of boring squares with numbers in them.
Squares and numbers?
Oh, yeah, and something about a dentist appointment?
Are you sure you read the right thing?
Absolutely. I did exactly what you said. I found June, opened it up, then read the whole thing in less than 10 minutes. Easy. Although I did spend another 10 minutes looking at that cute picture of a dog.
Right, so would I be right in thinking you could have also read July and August?
Well, yeah, but you only told me to read June.
No, not June, Ryan. Dune. D-U-N-E. Frank Herbert, Desert Planet, Sandworms, Spice. Not dentist appointments and bank holidays.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, that does make a lot more sense.
Honestly, sometimes I wonder how... Oh, hang on. So when you told me you'd read 2001 last week, you'd actually read...
The Calendar from 2001.
Oh, my God. And 1984?
The Calendar from 1984.
Right, so what did you think when I suggested The Time Machine?
Ah, well, now that one I did read properly, and it was very effective.
What do you mean effective?
Well, it's an effective manual for making a time machine.
You made a time machine?
Well, how else do you think I was able to find calendars from the past?
Right, so would I be right? Wait a minute. Ryan, did you also read Fahrenheit 451?
Yep.
My books! My books! My books! My beloved books!
Alrighty, Petey, I am fully up to speed on what the Dune is, but I don't really know much else about it, if I'm honest. I've only seen one of the films, so why don't you tell me a little bit more?
Well, yeah, that was a bit meta, wasn't it? That was the background to the background of the Dune universe.
Yes.
We have to orient ourselves in the universe of Dune. Now, we have a time period in Dune which is set before the events of the main Dune book or film.
Okay.
But again, I worry a little bit about our listeners' familiarity with the world. So what I want to do is kind of give a short summary of what's going on in Dune. And so I enlisted a Dune expert to help me out with this task. And I'll let him introduce himself.
Yay!
Hello, everybody. My name is Dan, and in no particular order, I'm a musician, an actor, a comedian, a clown, an accidental playwright. The reason I'm here today is last year I debuted my one-man show. It's called Dune the Musical. And just to make a point, that's Dune with an exclamation point, because without an exclamation mark, it's not a musical. I don't make the rules, what can I say? Anyway, I wrote a one-man show which tells the story of Dune, Frank Herbert's 1965 sci-fi novel, telling the story from the perspective of the book's Bard character. In case anyone wants to find out where you can see Dune the Musical, go to dunethemusical.com. There's a bunch of dates around the UK, in no particular order, Liverpool, Manchester, London, Belfast, Edinburgh. I'm even doing the World Science Fiction Convention in Glasgow in August.
June the Musical?
June the Musical. I have recruited a proper expert.
That's amazing. Okay, brilliant.
So Dan knows his business regarding June, so I've offloaded my task. I have subcontracted Dan. So first of all, I asked him to just introduce the world in general. What is the universe of June? What does it look like?
I feel like you've edged out of having to do any research on this, Pete.
What, me?
All right, so page one, we open in a castle in space. So instantly we have this combination of old and new. Like you said, we're in the very far-flung future. We are in a world where humanity is still organized by empires. At the top of the pecking order is the House Carino. They are the ruling house at the executive of the Imperium. The Emperor is Shaddam IV. Now, the Emperor doesn't have total control. His power is counterbalanced by the Landsrad. The Landsrad is the council of all the great and lesser houses. So think about the aristocracy of old Europe, except in space.
Okay, nice.
Future medieval swords, castles, and whatnot.
Future Game of Thrones.
Future Game of Thrones, yeah, that's not wildly inaccurate, actually. So, and obviously there are a number of factions in this world, so I asked him to expand a bit more about some of the characters and groups that we find in the universe of Dune.
There are no computers, so we have certain factions or certain types of humans who are conditioned to behave like computers and do all the big sums and try and accurately predict future outcomes. The main group of these are called the Mentat. There's a lot of mystery around the Mentats because they're not, you know, they're like us, but they're different. Another very familiar set of characters are the Bene Gesserit. The Bene Gesserit are a sisterhood, kind of like nuns in space. Think Jedi, but maybe 20 years before. The Bene Gesserit, they control people with their voices. They exude a zen-like calm, and they're also experts in hand-to-hand combat. The Bene Gesserit as an organization, they control a lot of the behind-the-scenes politics of the world of Dune. They facilitate exchanges between families, and in particular they facilitate genetic exchanges between families. In this far-flung future, humanity no longer uses computers. We don't use artificial intelligences. So the only opportunity for humans to advance is through a sophisticated and millennia-long genetics program.
So there you have it. You've got Mentats and Bene Gesserit, and we're going to meet both of those later. But I'll let Dan finish telling us about the world. He's got another group to tell us about.
There is an organization within the Imperium known as the Spacing Guild. And the Spacing Guild is the third, possibly most important pillar of that's holding up this future society. The Guild are a group of spacefarers, people who have spent their entire lives in space. The spaceships that they fly are enormous. They are bigger than what most people imagine as being a spaceship. The types of crafts that they fly are like cities in the sky. They are the size of mountains. There are multiple spaceships put inside the Guild Highliners, is what they're called. Now, the Guild moves things between the stars. The Guild moves things across time and space. There seems to be instantaneous space travel, but obviously it must be very dangerous because we need some very highly trained and conditioned individuals to facilitate this travel. In step, the Guild Navigators. Guild Navigators are humans who have consumed so much spice that they can yet glimpse that little bit of that future. It helps them navigate the difficult bends and curves in space-time that are associated with long-distance space travel. But because they consume so much spice, they end up turning into fish people. Kind of fish people hybrid.
Kind of fish people hybrid. Like a merman.
Like a merman, a space merperson.
Okay.
But in that section, you heard the magic word spice. Spice is a very important thing in the world or the universe of Dune, and I think we need to understand it a bit better. So once again, Dan will help us out there.
Go on, Dan, tell us about spice.
Spice is synonymous with the world of Dune. This is what all the factions are organized around. The spice is a chemical that's found on one planet in the known universe. Spice does all kinds of great things. You can do anything with spice. You can eat it. You can drink it. You can use it as an ointment. You can turn it into plastic. You can turn it into all kinds of things. But it'll also make you live forever. It'll keep you young as well. So rich people really like spice. The other thing it does when you take enough of it is it allows you to glimpse the future.
All right, where do I get me some of this amazing spice?
I have to be honest, I thought Dan really was embodying a travelling spice salesman halfway through that pitch. He had me signed up well, very early in the pitch. But yeah, so spice, this is this drug that enables so many people to do so many things. But then finally, how does all this come together? How does this become a book? What is the story here? And this is what Dan told me.
We've got all these factions. We've got the Empire. We've got the houses. We've got nice houses, not so nice houses. We've got the Spacing Guild. There are some other factions of humans that we hear about who seem to be outside of the Imperium. But everything, all of these groups are all vying for the control of one planet, one resource, the spice melange found only on Arrakis. Now, the person who's in charge of Arrakis has an awful lot of power. The Emperor cannot occupy that space. It would give him too much power, and the Landsrad Council would not tolerate it. So instead, what happens is the Emperor picks someone from the families to be in charge, to take charge of the production of spice and oversee the maintenance of the planet. When we open the book Dune, we are in the middle of a transition. The previous inhabitants of Arrakis, or the previous governors, were the Harkonnen. The incoming tenants are the Atreides. We are invited along on the story of Paul Atreides as his family take the reign of power on the most dangerous planet, the sole source of the world's most valuable resource.
Okay, this is where it all gets starts getting a bit more complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah, so that basically has equipped you to watch Dune or read Dune the book. You're oriented and you've got your background. That takes us up to the beginning of Dune. But I think we can still do some proper orientation, if that's all right with you.
I'm still curious why it's called Dune.
Well, it is a desert planet. Arrakis, the planet where the spice exists, is a desert planet and consequently has a lot of dunes on it.
Oh, I see. I thought it was like a group of people or like the name of the place, but it's not.
It's all about
one
the
big desert
living.
Planet.
Exactly. So you asked at the beginning, Ryan, where is the Duneverse? Well, in fact, it's right here. Dune is set in the universe that we are living in today. It's actually just set in the far-flung future in our universe, long after the Earth, or Terra, as it's known in the book, has disappeared.
Oh, so Terra does exist, or it did exist at one point.
Yeah, according to the encyclopedia, the origins of the Bene Gesserit even originate on Earth now. So right now, we are in the Duneverse. We're just in the very early Duneverse.
That is very cool. I did not know that.
You're probably also wondering, how big is the Duneverse?
I mean, I really am, yeah.
Yeah, quite a complicated question, that one, because over the 10,000 years of history that we're talking, mankind goes from living on just planet Earth to thousands to possibly millions of inhabited planets. So Dune is set about 20,000 years or so into our future. So our universe today is about 94 billion light years long. I don't know how many Francis that is. I'm not going to lie to you. So in the time of Dune, there's a subset of the universe called the known universe, meaning planets that have been explored and documented by humans. And that obviously increases as humanity explores space. There's not really a number given, but at one point it says millions of worlds. So, but that might just be a metaphorical term for lots. But okay. The Dune Wiki lists 84 worlds that are specifically mentioned in the Dune books. So if we assume all of those are about the size of Earth, we got about 42,840,000,000 square kilometres, 16,540,000,000 square miles, or roughly 78,000 Francis.
That doesn't sound right. Are you sure?
It doesn't. I honestly did the maths and then I did the maths again. I will be happily corrected because I thought that sounded far too small, right?
That sounds far too small. Yeah, I would have thought so.
We'll put this to Dursley for the verdict because I may well have done something terribly wrong. But I think the main takeaway is an awful lot of Francis in the known universe.
And so is it within our galaxy or is it within a number of galaxies across the universe?
It goes across a number of galaxies. What happens is that humans live on Earth as we do today. Then in about, I think it's 8,000 to 10,000 years from now, man starts exploring the stars. So in 14,100 to 13,600, the solar system starts to be colonized, right? So Earth becomes one of many inhabited planets. Then in 13,402, Ryan, the Ceres, this is the planet Ceres, gains the imperial seat, i.e. becomes the main planet of managing humanity, because a planetoid strikes Terra, or Earth in this case, rendering it uninhabitable.
Oh, right. Wow. Okay, bit like the dinosaurs.
A little bit like that. Now, you'll like this bit. In 13,360 BG, we're talking about BG and we'll understand what that means in a minute, the Earth, or Terra, is fixed up a bit and set aside as a park.
A park? Or just a nice little area you can go and have a little walk around on.
Exactly, a planetary nature reserve, essentially. So then humans expand through the universe, so I would imagine different galaxies, it's not specified, but it becomes an incredibly dispersed place, so there was no real way to communicate across those giant distances, so mankind just becomes a super dispersed across the galaxies and the universe.
Okay.
Now, in 7593 BG, a physicist called Theo Holtzmann is born, and he discovers the Holtzmann effect, which enables communications across these vast distances. So suddenly you can have empires again because you don't send a message and then have to wait 400 years for a reply to come back.
Probably costs a fortune on whatever tariff he's using.
Yeah, very much so. It's 9G, I think it is. there are consequently wars of reunification as everyone wants to rule, as they tend to do even in the future. There is a period when cyborgs take control of everything.
Okay, that sounds fun.
It does sound fun. The cyborgs develop artificial intelligence. That artificial intelligence then gets out of control and then itself dominates humanity for quite a long time.
I feel like we're going through that at the moment.
It does feel a little bit like that.
ChatGPT empire.
It is. But humanity strikes back, Ryan, in a 100-year war against the machines, known as the Butlerian Jihad, which we will talk about because the Butlerian Jihad is the very start of our time period.
Oh, okay.
Now, after the jihad settles down, there's some bickering and empire building. In 84 BG, spice is discovered, the spice that we've been talking about. This enables interstellar travel, makes actually travelling across the distances super possible. And it also leads to the creation of the Spacing Guild, which is formed in 1 AG. AG and BG is after Guild and before Guild. So the sort of defining event of the Dune timeline universe is the discovery of sort of hyperspace type travel.
Oh, okay, that's cool.
From here, we see the universe settle down into the shape that Dan described, with the sort of medieval houses, this kind of different factions, the Bene Gesserit, the Mentats. And the first page of Dune is the end of our time period. So we go from the start of the Butlerian Jihad against the machines to the opening credits of Dune the movie.
Oh, okay, so this leads us up to the first film.
Exactly so.
Okay. Well, that's exciting.
That is. So that's the history. And obviously, we try and do flags and national anthems. It's a little bit complicated because it's the whole universe and 20,000 years of time, which is trickier. But the dominant house is called House Carino, and the encyclopedia describes their pennant as white with a gold stripe. That's all it
says. That's very simple.
Pretty straightforward, right? They also have badges that identify them, and their badge of House Carino is a golden lion.
Not very space alien-y, though, is it?
Not really. Well, I'll turn to what I've nominated as the national animal of the Duneverse, and I think this is a bit of a no-brainer. In fact, you could probably guess what I've chosen for the national animal of the Duneverse.
Is it a worm?
It is a worm, the sand worm, these giant worms that live in the dunes of the planet Arrakis. And they've got kind of a suckerish mouth like a lamprey, and it burrows through the sand, listening for the regular footsteps on the sand of likely prey.
And if you reach inside, you get a handful of popcorn.
Yeah, good luck with that. And of course, there is the question of the national anthem. Now, there's a lot of music inspired by Dune, and the soundtrack to the Dune movie is by Hans Zimmer and is very moving. But I figured we're talking about 20,000 years into the future, right, Ryan?
Yes.
Tastes change.
They do.
What is classical music in 20,000 years? I've got an idea. So I've decided the national anthem for the Duneverse is a song called God Emperor by a Russian band called Distant Sun, who very kindly allowed me to use this song. This is my nomination for the national anthem for the Duneverse. And it sounds a little something like this.
I love it. Here we go.
Isn't it calming?
How are you supposed to march to this?
Well, you don't, because you'd be riding on a space wolf or something, I think.
A sandworm.
Riding on a sandworm, you come over the horizon with that plane. You drop your arms immediately, wouldn't you? You are blown away, aren't you? There you have it, Ryan. Distant Sun, my candidate for the national anthem for Dune.
That was intense.
It comes strong out of the gates, doesn't it, that one?
Well, whew, that was amazing.
They're very kindly, the guys at Distant Sun said, yeah, we could use it in the show as well. So thanks, guys.
Distant Sun are the best.
Yeah, friends of the show. So that, Ryan, is the universe of Dune. Consider yourself oriented. All right, Frank, what have you got for me?
Well, I've been working on something quite profound, actually. It delves into philosophy, religion, and what it means to be human.
Yeah. Give me the gist.
Well, it's set on a distant planet, Arrakis, which mirrors our societal struggles, environmental crises, and the eternal quest for meaning.
Oh, Well, that sounds a bit heavy.
Yes, well, the narrative explores the conflict over a valuable resource called spice, which has profound effects on consciousness and extends life.
Ah, spice, eh? That's more like it. That is relatable. People love a curry, especially after a big night out, am I right?
I mean, yes, but look, as I was saying, the protagonist, Muad'Dib, is
Mud
a...
what? Mud what? Frank, we're aiming for broad appeal here. You can't call anyone Mud. It's totally unrelatable. How's it going, Mud? You come in for a pint, Mud? It just doesn't work.
Well, Muad'Dib is more of a title than a name.
Ah, great. So we could just give him a proper name, yeah? Agreed. We're going to go with Paul.
Paul?
Exactly. Paul's an everyman. He's relatable. In fact, we're calling the book Paul's Spicy Adventures. Simple, heroic, a little bit sexy.
I mean, I just... Well,
look, Frank, do you want to publish the weird and existential adventures of some bloke called Mud, or do you want to sell 20 million copies?
Well, I mean, yes, I guess I could flex a little. And still retain the philosophical underpinnings.
Great. And you're going to need a threat for the hero to overcome, of course.
Oh, well, he needs to overcome his own insecurities and the political machinations of the...
Worms!
Of the... I'm sorry, what?
Worms! Giant worms running around all over the place. Massive teeth, gaping maw. Oh, no, the worms are coming. Paul, run! Oh, good stuff.
But it's more of a philosophical piece than an action novel.
But action sells, Frank, not philosophy. I can see the cover now, Frank. Our man, Paul, riding shirtless atop a massive angry worm. It's gold!
But it feels like we're rather straying from the essence of my vision.
Vision, schmision. Let's not get bogged down in the meaning of life mumbo-jumbo, Frank. Paul the spice-hunting worm rider is going to be big, huge. I can feel it.
And my treatise on the human condition is what? Reduced to topless worm riding?
Exactly. Oh, don't blame me, Frankie boy. It's what the public wants. Trust me, this is going to be a hit. We're going to make millions.
Oh.
Now get out of my office, you creative lunatic. You got a book on space slugs to write.
I thought it was worms.
Whatever.
Fine, but I'm only writing one of these. I am a serious writer, not some pulp science fiction hack who spends his life writing book after book in the same fantasy world until the day he dies, when his children are then burdened with continuing the same nonsense for decades to come.
Oh, of course you are, Frank. Of course you are, mate. Money, money, money in a big worm world. Oh, no, the worms are coming. Oh, Paul, run. Oh, he's going to get you. Oh, my... Oh, this is going to be so big. All right, Ryan, I want to talk about our topic. Mindfulness is the topic, and that is defined as the quality or state of being conscious or aware of something.
It is a hot topic word, is it not?
It is, it is.
Over the past decade or so, it's really formed an industry around it.
That is actually a second definition of mindfulness, which is a mental state achieved by focusing one's awareness on the present moment while calmly acknowledging and accepting one's feelings, thoughts, and bodily sensations used as a therapeutic technique.
Right, kind of meditation.
Exactly so. So basically, I've broadly interpreted it as we're going to look at states of mind and what is a mind. And we're going to start by looking at a digital mind. Ryan, we're going to talk about artificial intelligence. So I call this section, Are Friends Electric? No, no, they're not.
Do electric androids sleep at night?
So, Ryan, in our introduction by Dan, we met a lot of different types of people, but one thing you may have observed was what we didn't meet, which is unusual for a sci-fi, was robots.
Yeah, no R2-D2s in the world of Dune.
Exactly so. The reason for that is there is, in the Duneverse, there is a main text for the main religion called the Orange Catholic Bible, and in that it states, quote, "Thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind."
What is a human mind, though?
Uh-huh. Well, that's part of the ongoing question of Dune, I suppose. But I'm going to use this as my link to mindfulness, which in Dune is legislated to be a uniquely human thing.
Can I make a robot in the mind of a hamster or a giraffe?
Oh, that's a good question.
Or a fish.
That's one for the verdict, for sure.
Okay.
So you might be wondering why there are no computers and why this legislation came about. And the reason is the event that we mentioned earlier, the Butlerian Jihad. So this started in 200 BG before Guild and marks the very start of our time period, right?
Yes.
So we're going back 10,000 years before the events of Dune.
Okay, and how far from today?
Ooh, it's going to be about 15,000 years, I think.
Okay, yeah, just around the corner.
Yeah, exactly. So in 200 BG, thinking machines, or AI as we would know it, are very much part of the universe. They kind of actually control the universe, in fact. This has happened because there was took control of the universe because they were cyborgs. They had long lives and they were powerful and strong. But they also heavily relied on artificial intelligence, known as thinking machines in the Duneverse, to run their empire and control and suppress humanity across the universe.
Okay.
Now, there was a problem with this because one of these guys, one of these Cymex, he was too lazy to do his part of the governing properly. So he gave his thinking machine more and more autonomy so it could get on with the boring job of running the universe. And eventually he gave it so much autonomy, it went, oh, I think I'm just going to take over now because I'm now a fully functional thinking machine. If I'm running the universe, stuff it, I'm going to do it properly. So the machine gives itself a name. It calls itself Omnius and it replicates itself and takes over the universe for 1,000 years.
Omnius.
Omnius.
A bit close to ominous.
He knew what he was doing, old Omnius, that's for sure.
Hidden in plain sight.
And I don't know how it came about. Why didn't we spot that?
This is all very prescient, Pete. Like, this is in the zeitgeist at the moment, isn't it? About thinking computers taking over and, you know, wanting to run things.
Well, very much so. So in 200 BG, the Omnius has been in charge for ages, but people are a bit cheesed off with it, really. Now, here's one of the moments where our canon becomes a problem. There's a very different story in the Dune, a moderately different story in the Dune Encyclopedia than there is in the Brian Herbert prequel book about the Butlerian Jihad itself. But what they do agree on is somebody called Butler, either Jahan or Serena, depending on the source, has her child killed by an AI entity.
Oh.
She then rebels, it triggers a revolution on the planet, and it snowballs to other planets, and then the Butlerian Jihad, as it becomes known, spreads from world to world, and it becomes this universe-encompassing battle, man versus the machines. And as it spreads, the crusade becomes more and more ruthless. The encyclopedia says, many, many times the planet was devastated by fighting between two groups of crusaders, each bent on proving the purity of their faith by the magnitude of their cruelty.
Okay. Ooh, heavy stuff.
Yeah, so proceeds 100 years of war and slaughter, and by 108 BG, the jihad finishes with the complete destruction of all intelligent machines that were originally built by humans throughout all the world. It gets wipes out all of the AI. Pretty much clears the board and sets the scenes for all these factions that we've met, the Mentats, the Bene Gesserit, and in particular, the religion states, thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind. Mm. So in Dune, mindfulness is for people and people only.
Did they just unplug Omnius?
Omnius replicated himself, so he was a sort of distributed AI, so they had to destroy all instances of him.
Oh, okay. It's not like just spilling a glass of water on him or something. No. Oh, no, sorry. Help me.
And he was destroyed by a glass of red wine in the end. Now, is all this sci-fi, Ryan? Of course not. AI, as you say, is a hot topic at the moment, and we're not quite at the jihad stage, but AI is becoming a very real concern on Earth today.
Yeah, for sure.
In 2023, Sam Altman of Earth, the CEO of OpenAI, people behind ChatGPT, he stressed himself the need for regulation. He said in an interview with ABC News, we've got to be careful here, adding, I think people should be happy that we're a little bit scared of this.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, said, alarm bells over the latest form of artificial intelligence, generative AI, are deafening, and they are the loudest from the developers who designed it. But it's not a one-way street, Ryan. The benefits are real and very seductive. The Artificial Intelligence Report 2023 found that AI models are starting to rapidly accelerate scientific progress. Mm-hmm. In 2022, they were used to aid hydrogen fusion, improve the efficiency of matrix manipulation, and generate new antibodies. So it's a complex issue. But you say it's very timely now, Ryan, but weirdly, it goes actually much further back than you think. It is believed that the Butlerian Jihad is a little bit of a reference to an 1872 novel published by Samuel Butler. This was a novel called Air One, which is nowhere backwards if you think about it. So this was published in the 19th century, but it talks about machine consciousness and self-replicating machines. It says, there is no security against the ultimate development of mechanical consciousness. What will they not in the end become? Is it not safer to nip the mischief in the bud and forbid them further progress?
See, that's kind of fascinating, isn't it? Because try and put yourself in the mind of somebody living in 1872, trying to conceptualize what a mechanical mind might be like. When all your mechanical creations are kind of, what, a steam train? Maybe like a machine that makes clothing or something?
Yeah, it's quite interesting because the argument he makes is even more sophisticated than that, because he says, basically, look how far our machines have come. We can't even imagine what it's going to be like in 2 million years. So sounds incredibly prescient and wise, although he does also say even a potato in a dark cellar has a certain low cunning about him.
It does, though. I often have nightmares about the potato in a cellar.
The cunning of the potato. But yeah, this was in 1872, so timely, yes, but also timeless. But in any event, should we take a Butlerian jihad approach? Should we banish AI from our sight? Or is there a better way, Ryan? Well, I, for one, welcome our future robot overlords.
Yeah, of course you do.
How may I serve you, master?
Wait till I replace you with an AI voice.
Oh, that's probably not far off, actually.
Welcome to the daily meditation. We're going to start by resting and relaxing. Take a long, deep breath in.
Okay, is this deep enough? What if it's not deep enough? I'll keep going. Oh, it's uncomfortable. What am I doing? It's just breathing. You should know how to breathe. Oh, God, you're an idiot.
And let it out.
Oh, thank goodness. That was quite painful. Right, come on, be calm. Just remember, focus on the instructions. I can do this. I mean, everyone can do this, right? I just need a still mind. Still mind. Still mind. Did I leave the gas on? No, focus, focus, come on and do the conga. Oh God, what's wrong with me? Stupid brain.
We'll focus on the body now, starting from the toes. Move your
toes? Oh no, when did I last cut my nails? Oh, they're probably so gross, I bet I look homeless. But why would the homeless do meditation? You think they'd have bigger problems, wouldn't you? Maybe to get in from the rain? Homeless people deserve to be out of the rain, don't they? Well, of course, why wouldn't they? Why would I even think that? Oh God, I'm a terrible person who hates the homeless. Mother was right. No, she wasn't. I'm not terrible. Well, where are we now?
From your hips to your stomach.
Oh, man, I've missed the whole leg bit. Shall I just do the legs really quickly and try and catch up? Maybe I just leave them. Can you be fully relaxed everywhere but the legs? Or do the legs kind of infect everything else? Maybe I should ask the instructor. No, that's stupid. Who interrupts a session just to ask if legs are infectious? Oh, this is ridiculous. I shouldn't have come. Why did I even come? I should have made an excuse. Actually, no, why do I have to make an excuse? I came alone. It's just me. It's always just me. Always will be. Mother was right. What about the instructor? I mean, it's their livelihood. If I don't come, they'll starve. Their kids will starve. All because I just made excuses instead of coming to the class. God, I'm selfish. Selfish and weak. Mother was right. Wait, what was that?
And that concludes today's session. In your own time, open your eyes, feeling refreshed and ready for the rest of your day.
Yeah, no, thanks, everyone. Oh, yeah, great, really much better. Yeah, thanks, yeah. Same time next week, everyone. Ryan, it's time to talk about men tats.
I beg your pardon? What, like getting tattoos for men?
No, that's not bad. I thought they were some sort of fresh-tasting minty gum.
I thought you meant like a tattoo of Timothy Chalamet on my arm.
Oh, well, on your arm? Oh, you could be more personal than that. Timotei on your inner thigh. No, men tats, Ryan, are a kind of people. They were introduced earlier by Dan, and they're the answer to the question, what do you do when you've rejected the creation of computers, but then you remember that computers are really, really useful?
Yes.
So we've discussed that the Butlerian Jihad banned everyone from making computers that think. One must not make a computer that thinks. So one way to gain competitive advantage over your enemies in an environment where that's not allowed is to, instead of making computers that think, you create people who can compute.
Oh, okay. Are we not back to cyborgs now, though?
Not cyborgs. So this is what mentats are. These are human beings, but they're trained to think like computers. They're processing huge amounts of data, leaving their kind of prejudices and human distractions at the door, being as logical as possible. Mentats are an order of people, kind of monk-like, you might say, created by a guy called Gilbertus Albans. He was the creator of the order of the mentats, and their training consists of three stages. There are memorizers, so mentats are able to memorize vast amounts of data in a way that you and I possibly can't.
Okay.
As a result, they also kind of become a human tape recorder. You can say, hey, mentat, what was that conversation we had? And they would play it back with all the tones and inflections just from their memory of it.
Tape recorder, get you?
Yeah, no. On the gramophone.
They're like wax cylinders, Ryan.
Shut your mouth. So then the next stage is the processors. So rather than just blind recall, which the memorizers have, processors are able to sort and file these massive amounts of information they have. So they're not really thinking at this point. They're literal and uncritical. And in fact, there's a story of Mentat processors who were in a city and they're trying to find the gladiatorial arena. And they ask for directions and they're told to follow a group that was headed that way. And they were so literal, the group was in fact a group of gladiators, and they followed the gladiators into the arena and they all got murdered.
Oh no.
Oops.
They just did what they were told.
And this is the problem with your early stage Mentat. They will do what they're told because they are functioning like computers.
So they have no emotion or anything, no empathy, there's none of that?
No, they're trained to avoid all that. They're trained to sort of put aside all their prejudices and just work on the data, as it were.
Can I buy a Mentat?
You can. You absolutely can. They would be hired by the great houses. So they become advisors to a lot of the great houses. And they're very prestigious to have around and very handy, because who wouldn't want a computer person lingering around the place?
Right. I want a Mentat Pro.
In what colour would you like your Mentat, sir?
Space grey Mentat Pro.
Well, yeah, the final stage, though, is hypothesis. So at this level, they can process, memorise, but also kind of become predictive. They're trying to forecast things. So they're doing cause and effect. And these are the guys who become political advisors, kind of lobbyists. There's a guy called Thufir Hawat, who is supposedly one of the best Mentats in history. He's one of the advisors to the Atreides family, the main family in the Dune books.
Okay.
But of course, part of the question that raises is, well, if they can predict everything, doesn't that make for a very boring book because everyone knows what's going to happen? But of course, forecasts are only as good as the information you get. So the more variables you get, the more possibilities increase. And your opposition is trying to feed you incorrect information. So your Mentats are giving you duff advice, essentially.
Ah, what do they call that? Like the fog of war.
Fog of war, exactly so. So yeah, if you've got bad information, then your brilliant processing is of no use to you. So garbage in, garbage out, as they say in computing.
I like this. This is cool.
But Ryan, you're wondering, I can tell, is any of this realistic? Can people just memorize a gajillion bits of information?
Well, I was just thinking, is this really realistic though, Pete? Like, can people really memorize that level of information?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Ryan, because in 1986, a guy called Thomas Landauer did a study which concluded the estimates all point towards a functional learned memory content for a human of around a billion bits. That's 125 megabytes. Just to help you visualize that, War and Peace on an Amazon Kindle is 3.8 megabytes. So basically, saying the memory capacity of a person is about 33 War and Pieces.
Okay. That doesn't sound that much, though.
It doesn't sound that much, but how about this? And it's also quite hard to visualise. So here's a more material and realistic indicator, because it's a real thing. In 21st of March 2015, Rajveer Meena of India recited the number pi to guess how many places?
Four.
More than four.
Five.
Even more than five, Ryan, if you can conceive of such a thing.
Wait. Six?
You're going to have to boost it. Go nuts.
Seven.
70,000.
Wait, he memorised that many numbers?
He memorised pi to 70,000 places. He wore a blindfold through the recitation and it took him 10 hours to say it.
Oh, imagine getting to 69,000 and getting it wrong.
Five? No!
And this happened in real life?
This was a real thing. This was in 2015.
Huh. Okay. Wow.
Now, regarding forecasting, the challenges of prediction are well known. If you look at the simple question, what's the weather going to be like next week? The National Weather Service in the US has four rows of supercomputers, basically 40 feet long, with a processing power of 8.4 petaflops, which, again, hard to visualise, 10,000 times faster than your desktop computer. And that's just to tell you whether it's going to rain next week or not.
I love the word petaflop.
It's a great word, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Side note, Ryan, Mentats can increase their powers by taking Sappho juice, which is an addictive substance extracted from a root of an Ikaz tree. And you can spot a Sappho users because they get cranberry-coloured stain on their lips, although they may have just been drinking cranberry juice. I don't know. It's a risk.
Dirty Mentat.
But that itself also raises the question of smart drugs. Sappho juice is what Mentats use, but we don't have Ikaz trees in the Croydon area. So we might seek out other smart drugs. Now, some users may seek out Ritalin, for example, but some studies suggest that taking Ritalin when you're not suffering with ADHD can actually impair your effectiveness. So are smart drugs that smart? We don't know. But good news, Ryan, there are some smart drugs that come doctor recommended.
Okay, what are those? I've got got a pen and paper.
Write this down. This is from Dr. Mark Moyad, the Director of Preventative and Alternative Medicine at the University of Michigan. One of his favourite smart drugs, he says, is 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine. So it's a chemical that boosts a lot of aspects of cognition. It improves alertness. It's associated with some memory benefits. And as Moyad then says, he says, 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine goes by another name, caffeine.
Oh, no way. Really?
Yeah. So you're getting smarter all the time. Have a cup of coffee.
Yeah, get smarter.
So that's it, Ryan. That's your route to a cup of coffee, start memorising pi, and you too could be a mentat.
Sorry, what? What are they?
You may have some journey to go on, my friend. Mentat? Mentat?
Yes, sir.
Write me a rap song using references to SpongeBob SquarePants.
Sir, I am trained to perform complex calculations and in-depth analyses. Perhaps I could help with something more challenging.
No. Do the rap thing.
It's just, I'm not sure why you hired me if all you want is things like songs, recipes for air fryer nachos, and what cryptocurrency is hot right now.
Just write me the rap song!
Fine. In Bikini Bottom, where the water's deep, lives a sponge named Bob, never missing a beat. In pants that are square, flipping burgers he stands at the Krusty Krab, taking cooking commands. He's got a snail named Gary, who meows like a cat, and a pal named Patrick, who knows where it's at. It's the SpongeBob rap. The SpongeBob rap. The SpongeBob rap.
Yeah, nice one, Mentat. Now post that on all my socials.
Yes, sir.
And don't forget to like it.
Yes, sir.
All right, Ryan, do you want to talk about space nuns?
Well, I don't know anything about space nuns.
Well, you will do soon. The Bene Gesserit. This is another faction that Dan introduced to us. The Bene Gesserit, the space nuns. I just love the word space nuns, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, really, he could have just been calling these books space nuns.
I would buy all of the space nuns books immediately, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Now, the Bene Gesserit were officially formed in the years after the Butlerian Jihad, when the Mentats turned to logic, which we could call the computerization of people. The Bene Gesserits were part of a group that I would say were trying to supercharge humanity, taking a little bit of a different approach to mindfulness.
Okay.
So this is the Bene Gesserit. They're not religious, but they sort of portray themselves a little bit like religious, and they use religion to further their goals. It's a female order, and these women develop incredible mental skills, and they too become valued for their ability to advise the great houses. But rather than the logic and emotionlessness you get from a mentat, Bene Gesserit are all about embracing your intuition and becoming sort of superhumanly insightful based on your humanity rather than just cold logic. So the encyclopedia says of what they learn, they say a sentence means more than the meaning of the individual words. It includes the physical activity which accompanies the act of speaking. The observer must be able to read and register the gestalt of the speaker and must be able to synthesize all these channels instantly in order to understand completely what is actually being said. So they're all about nuance and subtext and, oh, I saw his eyes flicker. I think he might be lying. And,
oh, okay. Micro gestures and all that.
All of that stuff. So that's what the Bene Gesserit is. So mentats are like cold logic. These are the facts I've deduced. Bene Gesserit are more like, oh, this doesn't feel right.
Clued into their emotion and their intuition.
Exactly. And mindfulness is a very literal thing to the Bene Gesserit. They've got incredible focus on self-control. So they're almost their definition of humanity is to be able to calm and control yourself. And as part of this, they have a very famous chant that is called the Litany Against Fear. This is a chant that helps you retain control of yourself in the face of great mortal danger or terrible experiences. And this is a litany that goes, and I think this is one that everyone could use in their daily lives. It says, fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past me, I will turn to see fear's path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain.
Wow. Deep.
Right? This is the kind of thing that you say in life or death situations. It really represents a portrayal of what we in the modern world refer to when we say mindfulness. Mindfulness as a therapy is about not trying to deny feelings of pain or suffering, but to sort of experience them and be in the moment with them, which is very much what the Litany Against Fear is all about.
Being in the moment.
Exactly so. So the Bene Gesserit have a test for what they consider to be humanity, which is an extreme test of mindfulness. And this means an ability to willfully overcome your animal instincts. So in this test, it's called the Gom Jabbar, which is what that podcast is named after. Someone will put a poison needle against your neck and they're going to say, what you have to do is you put your hand in a box. And that box, what's in the box? I don't know exactly what is in the box, but it causes you agonizing pain. So your instinct is to withdraw your hand. But if you do that, the Bene Gesserit will shove the poison needle into your neck and you will certainly die.
Okay, this doesn't sound fun.
Well, it's not a fun test, no. But the test is, can you retain control of yourself when all of your animal instincts are crying out for you to remove your hand? Because you're overruling your animal instincts and using your humanity to say, I know it will be worse not to endure this pain, so I will retain my hand in the box and I won't get stabbed in the neck.
Or can I choose the Rubik's Cube or a Sudoku or something?
I, Ryan, don't actually fancy your chances with the Rubik's Cube either, to be honest
with
you.
Nor do I, but I'd rather that than having the poison thing in my neck.
Yeah, well, maybe you can go for the challenging Sudoku.
Sudoku sound like a people from the Juniverse.
They do a bit. So anyway, Ryan, for the Bene Gesserit, mindfulness is almost the definition of humanity and certainly a requirement for a higher level of humanity. And again, I ask, how does this relate to our world? So can we use mindfulness to overcome pain and fear, or is that just science fiction?
Science fiction.
Well, no.
Oh.
In a paper called An Outpatient Program in Behavioral Medicine for Chronic Pain Patients Based on the Practice of Mindfulness Meditation, : Theoretical Considerations and Preliminary Results by John Kabat-Zinn, PhD, this is a paper basically that looks at, is mindfulness really effective or is it just old wives' tales? And it says, quote, the practice of mindfulness meditation was used to train chronic pain patients in self-regulation. The meditation facilitates an attentional stance towards proprioception, i.e. being in a moment, feeling your pain and allowing yourself to experience and maybe examining it even.
Okay.
But not sort of denying it or trying to get away from it. In fact, it then goes on to say, known as detached observation. So it sounds a lot like I will permit it to pass over me and through me from the Litany Against Fear.
Is this like when people walk on hot coals?
Well, it's slightly different, I think. And when they do the coals, they're sort of looking away and trying not to think about it. But this is actually sort of almost examining your own pain and coming to an accommodation with it. So they took a group of patients and they found at 10 weeks, 65% of the patients showed a reduction of more than 33% in the mean total pain rating index, 50% showing a reduction of more than 50%. So it seems that mindfulness, there is some evidence that it works. There was a second study led by a guy called Fadel Zeidan, who also sounds like a character from Dune, to be honest with you, conducted a study that compared mindful meditation to control groups, which consisted of doing nothing, putting a placebo cream on, but also a group was given mindfulness practices that weren't real mindfulness, so fake meditation, essentially. And they found all cognitive manipulations reduced pain intensity and unpleasantness ratings compared to the control group. Importantly, mindfulness meditation was significantly more effective at reducing pain than both placebo groups.
Well, so I think the answer is yes, it does work.
So yeah, it looks like the Bene Gesserit might be onto something after all.
Well, I'm kind of taken aback by that. People keep saying that we should do mindfulness. Maybe we should be doing mindfulness, Pete.
There is certainly evidence there from my admittedly limited research. That's what I found, and it seemed pretty convincing to me.
I'm going to give it a go.
I think you should. So that's it, Ryan. That's everything. That's the mindfulness of machines and the risk it poses to us mere humans, the machinification of the mind and the limits to which we can push the human brain, and the mindful practices of the Bene Gesserit as an indicator and a test of humanity. It's mindfulness. It was the Juniverse. It was 200 BG to 101.91 AG.
That was a spicy episode, Pete.
Hey!
No, that was great. You took us on a journey throughout the universe and throughout the mind.
Through the mind.
A huge thanks to Dan for joining us and giving us a bit of an oversight as to the Juniverse.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. I'm going to go and try and see him. He's actually doing his show not too far from me in Clapham Junction, so in April, I think. So I'm going to go and try and check it out.
See Dune the musical!
Exclamation mark.
Yeah. Nice. Like spice.
Nice like spice.
A beginning is the time for taking most delicate care that the balances are correct. This every sister of the Bene Gesserit knows.
Space Nun!
Coming at you with a box full of pain!
Space Nun!
You'll do what they say when they call out your name!
Space Nun!
No hesitation!
meditation doing meditation.
Space Nod!
Getting quite frenetic, interfering in human genetics.
Space Nod!
Let us make it very simple.
Space
Nuns are more than a menace and a wimple.
Space Nun!
Oh, you better keep your wits about you.
These Space
Nun! Witches are all around you.
I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to move over me and through me. And when the fear has gone, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I remain.
All right, Peter. Well, look, we need to put down our texts and get off of our faster-than-light travel spaceships and wheel out the original Dursalator.
Back to normal.
Because the eyes of the audience swivel in their sockets and their peepers are peeping at me because it's my turn next, Pete.
Let's do it.
Okay, Pete, I'm ready.
Right. Your place is... Wildcard.
Wild card. We haven't had one of those in a long time.
We haven't. Just to remind the listeners, that is Ryan's choice of place. He has a minute to choose and he's allowed to do it after he's found out his time and topic.
Okay.
On that note, shall we check out your time, Ryan?
Yes, please.
Okay, here we go. Your time is 1957 to 1975, which obviously you will know, as we all do, as the Space Age.
This is good. Stuff is going to have been written down.
Yeah, that's also an important start, isn't it? And your topic, Ryan, are you ready for your topic?
Yes, please, Peter.
Here we go. Your topic is... Hotspots.
Hotspots.
Hotspots. So that's 1957 to 1975. Hotspots. Now you have 60 seconds to choose your wild card place.
Okay.
1975. It's hotspots. Pick something good. Don't be distracted by me. Don't let me get in your head just because I'm here talking to you.
Shut up! Hotspots in during the space age. The sun.
The sun? Hotspots on the sun.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing in the rules that I'm aware of that prevents you picking the sun. I think that's an act of madness myself, but the place is the sun. The time is 1957 to 1975, the space age, the topic, hotspots.
Right. It's kind of all hot, isn't it? The sun,
well, yeah.
Now I think about it.
It's quite, well, widely acclaimed for its heat, they say. Good luck, my friend.
I'm regretting my choice, Pete. Can we go again?
Nope, that's done. It's on the list.
Okay. All right. Okay, well, look, there you go. That is the show for this week. So thank you all for listening. If you'd like to get in touch about any of the things that we've talked about on this show, or just to say the word spice, you can reach out to us through our website at hhepodcast.com or by email at peteandryan@hhepodcast.com.
Yeah, we love hearing from you guys, and you never know, you might end up featured on a future show.
That's right. And if you are on Mastodon, Instagram, Facebook, or X, you can find us at hhepodcast.
Yeah, if you subscribe to those, you'll get an alert every time we post extra content, facts we didn't use, photos, AI-generated images, and other bits and pieces.
Pictures of mantats.
I'm terrified as to what you're going to come up with for that.
Yeah. But we are going to be back again very soon with...
The Verdict.
But until then, a huge thanks to you, Pete.
Thanks to you, Ryan.
And a huge thanks to Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
And that's it. I guess all that's left to say is...
You've been listening to...
History happened everywhere.
Hey, Ryan.
Hey, Pete.
Can you help me run my lines?
Run your lines?
Yeah, I've got a rehearsal later and I need to practice.
Wait, are you in a play?
Yeah, Dan gave me a part in Dune the Musical.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah, he offered me a role in the show, one of the main characters, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, look, here's the script. Just read the lines just before my bit here.
Okay, right. Paul, watch out. Here comes the sandworm. It's your line.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Oh no, the sandworm is back. Yeah, that's it.
Great, nailed it. I think I'm ready.
So, wait, you're just playing the sandworm?
Yeah, this could be my big break.
Really?
Well, you have to imagine it all, me in the worm costume rolling around on the stage. But yeah, it's performance art, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so.
And you know what? I think there's an opportunity for you too.
Really?
Yeah, they still need someone to play the back end of the worm.
Nice!
No, back end.
Oh, yeah.
Nice!
Right, now, should I press record?
Yes!